Hashrad Up is back. First episode. Last time I spoke to Ethan Vera, who was on the show today, was a little more than over a year ago. We're talking industry development since then, Africa, their ASIC trading desks, Luxor News, and much more. Enjoy the show. All right. Welcome back, everybody, to Hashrad Up. First episode after a short break. Quick one. We have Ethan back on the show today, Ethan Vera from Luxor. Last time we spoke, Ethan was pretty much exactly a year ago. I quickly want to check where we're at with block height. We are at 890596. The last time we spoke was 836155. We're at 828 exahashes at the moment. Network hash rate. Where do you think we were last time we spoke?
About a year ago. Mm-hmm. I want to say we're like mid to high 600s, right?
598.
Okay.
A little more than 300 exahashes, dude. That's insane. From that base, it's crazy. Hash price, what do you think last time we spoke a year ago?
85? No, 40, let's say 75.
100.
100.
Yeah. This is today we...
April 2024. Wow.
Rough. $47 today. Where, how do you see, first, let's go into that first. How do you sort of see the Bitcoin mining industry developing since last time we spoke? 12 months have gone past. We're not at 100. We're now at 47. For a long time, we've been hovering 47, 50, 60-ish. What are your thoughts? How does it impact Luxor as a business?
Yeah, I'm sure I made a lot of estimations and guesses in that podcast a year ago that probably didn't play out exactly as I thought. And hey, let's do it again today. Let's throw out some predictions and revisit in a year. But yeah, I think it's definitely been a tough year for folks in the mining space from an economic standpoint. We saw quite a big run up in Bitcoin price at the end of 24, but that was really done in parallel at a time in which network difficulty was marching up with that network hash rate. At the same time, transaction fees have been somewhat lackluster and certainly hasn't had the same trajectory as we thought it would, you know, heading out of the, you know, ordinal craze and then the halving. So mining economics as a result have suffered quite a bit. And, you know, miners are facing that pressure, which has kind of helped lead them to make certain decisions, such as prioritize HPC and AI in some of their narratives, lead them to things like mergers and acquisitions in order to reduce, you know, SG&A costs, look at things like firmware adoption to potentially squeeze extra life for their hardware. And then I guess to feed the CapEx cycle, really spend a lot of money on new generation machines. So that whole economics conversation has really driven the past year and is continuing to drive decision-making for these big mining companies.
I mean, you guys are running a trading desk. I think it's been roughly a year now, a bit more, I think. What companies do you see deploy a lot of money into new gen hardware? Is it more public companies or do you see private ones doing it as well? And if so, where do they get the money from if they cannot dilute their shareholders?
Yeah, and a lot of this data is publicly available, which is nice on the public side. MinerMag has like data sets on this. And so roughly public companies went from like 15% market share of the industry to like north of 30%. So a lot of the growth over the past year has been at the companies that are listed on markets. And really, I think that's a function of just a better avenue to raise capital in. They've been in kind of the first bit period there, they were hammering on their ETM, so equity offerings, basically, you know, issuing new shares, getting capital into the business. Kind of in the second half of the year, they started looking at more kind of debt instruments, things like convertible notes, sometimes posting some of their BTC on balance sheet to reduce their cost of debt. But really, the public markets have been such an effective tool for some of these miners to raise capital, something that the private markets, you know, just don't have. And so that's, I think, why we've seen just an explosion of PubCo hash rate over the time period. And we continue to expect that trend to continue to occur. Our trading desk does interface with some private companies that are raising, you know, equity and debt capital through a number of, you know, different products. But certainly I think the growth has come majority from PubCos.
Yeah. How long can that continue, do you think, in the same way, before even shareholders say, like, look, enough is enough? because, well, I mean, I'm getting back into it, right? But the last offer I saw was from Galaxy, I think, and they offered like 10% loans to mining companies. And 10%, I mean, it's crazy if we're talking at $47 hash price, right?
Yeah, I think some mining companies will continue to be successful in kind of following a new narrative and finding a unique story for the market. So somebody like Marathon, for example, I think they've done a very good job at seeing the success of MicroStrategy with Bitcoin on balance sheet and quickly, you know, replicating that and you know, crossing that 10,000 BTC in treasury mark. And then I think now they're at, you know, some multiple of that. And the market's really like that. And so that was a good kind of, you know, pivot. Then you have folks like, you know, Galaxy and CoreSci that have, you know, stacked up some pretty big wins on the HPC side with deals with people like CoreWeave. So that's a good narrative that will continue to feed interest into the stock. Then you have some folks like Hut 8, for example, which just had, you know, their spinoff of American BTC with the Trump sons a couple days ago. So people are finding kind of unique ways to gather kind of an angle for investors and continue to funnel money into the company, both through equity and debt. But then there's kind of the tail end of public companies that are having a hard time finding a narrative, finding a differentiator. And for them, they're struggling. And you can see that basically in their market cap just continues to decrease over time while some of the big giants continue to increase in market cap.
Is it maybe time for them to look at sort of fringe mining with their old gear? A lot of these projects, and I want to speak to you about hash rate growth in Africa. I know you've been traveling a bit last year, and I think it plays into this, right? My theory or the general theory is, okay, you know, Bitcoin mining revenue is going to sort of decline over the long term, and it's going to force efficiency, right? The one that gets paid for the power at some point wins. That, you know, arguably cheap power that nobody wants is mainly found in Africa. Is it maybe time for these guys to use all of their old gear that they don't have any use for anymore at 4 cents grid power in the US to ship that elsewhere and find alternative use cases? I'm working on some solar stuff with like 20-30% uptime, you know, and I always say to people who look at me like I'm crazy, who come from the energy industry, when I talk to them about ROIs within 6 months, because these machines don't cost anything, right? Because elsewhere in the world, they're paperweights. That these are plays that can be looked at. Do you see that happening as well from PubCos at all, or is that not really in their interest, way too high risk? What's your thoughts around this?
It's a lot of good topics in one. So let me riff on this for a bit. Certainly, I think there's probably no real reason why a mining company that is, you know, sub 1% of the network, let's say, you know, maybe a couple exahash worth of hash rate, really should be public moving forward. Being public, you know, comes with so many additional costs, everything from like D&O insurance to listing fees. And really, like, you would expect these companies to be better off like merging with each other or going private. It really doesn't make sense to have like 30 companies that are operating at small scale, all public markets. That's kind of, you know, one piece to it. I think that's going to help some of these companies survive is basically reducing that SG&A cost as a percentage of revenue by consolidating. But certainly I think like they're sitting at an interesting dilemma where a lot of them raised capital in the 21-22 cycle, deployed into S19J Pros and S19 XP is like basically, you know, the generation previous to this. And they're largely running those machines up into now, and they haven't really been able to raise the capital to refresh their fleet to the latest gen machines, at least an entire overhaul of their entire fleet. And so they are sitting at an interesting dynamic where they've been reporting revenue and they don't want to give up that revenue and unplug those old generation machines, but they can't afford the newest gen to quickly replace them. And so I do think they need to start looking for, you know, alternatives in light of, you know, keeping these machines profitable. As you mentioned, like eventually a lot of them will cross into negative profitability lines where 5 cent plus OPEX, you know, let's call it 5.5, no longer is an S19J Pro really profitable to run. And so you do need to find a unique angle to that. I think international markets is one answer. Intermittent energy is definitely another answer, and that can be both international and domestic. But those are definitely plays that I think these miners should consider. I think we'll probably riff on Africa for a while, but just quickly on your topic of like solar power and potentially like, you know, behind the meter, co-located directly with an energy asset, I think it's really interesting for some of these companies to consider that almost as like a graveyard mining site, right? Where they can plug in their M30Ss and S19s and J Pros basically and finish off their lifetime of the next 1, 2, 3 years. Otherwise it wouldn't be, you know, profitable to for them to run. So a 30% uptime opportunity that's, you know, close to 1 cent power, I think is a good outcome for a lot of these machines. At the same time, there's considerations here. You have to find a way to minimize your CapEx. So you can't spend $400 or $400,000 a megawatt to build out your container or your facility. You'll never return your investment on that with that uptime. And you certainly can't import machines at, you know, $200 a machine from a shipping logistics perspective plus tariff. Again, you'll never return your investment. So you got to find ways to minimize CapEx, minimize your shipping and tariff costs, and basically get those machines to the graveyard site. But yeah, maybe I'll pause there because there's like two different topics in one here.
Yeah, I wrote a couple questions down as well. We'll definitely riff on Africa just now. So when I do the bit of consulting that I do, right, I tell my clients, look, you need to have somewhat of a pipeline, right? Yes, you can have one site. Yes, you can have end of life strategy. You can sell your machines. Okay, cool. But what's really neat is if you have a very low risk, higher cost, a jurisdiction where you can deploy your high CapEx machines, and then you sort of funnel them down until, you know, they become, I don't know, decorative pieces in people's offices or something, you know. And I don't see much of that yet. I don't see that sort of cohesive pipeline and strategy of saying, look, we're going to deploy these miners here. The lifetime is going to be, I don't know, MicroBT M60S plus what, 4 years? These machines run much longer if they're maintained well, right? And then we're going to, you know, send it to, I don't know, Ethiopia or the UAE, or we're going to clean them up and dunk them in immersion and overclock them or something like that. You know, I don't see much of that happening yet. And a lot of miners who sort of look at the AI play with a bit of a frown, you know, they just say like, look, if you do the AI, you're either public or you're a bad miner. And I think that has to be part of it. It's no longer enough to buy the machines, plug them in and run them until they ROI'd. You got to have like a 10-year strategy for these machines that you buy, maintain them well. I don't know. It's 10 years probably too much, but like, yeah, what are your thoughts? How long do these machines last? And when do you think we'll see that, if at all?
Yeah, so, well, I think from a hardware perspective, it does depend on the operating condition of the machines during the lifetime, as you said, and also the machine make. So if you can take like the gold standard, which was the Nminer S9 released in 2017, and you're operating that at a good facility, I mean, some of those machines are still in operation today, 8 years later, right? Now that's kind of like the peak I think that we could expect is like an 8-year hardware life cycle, best machine out there, best operations. But if you're talking about, you know, maybe like the S19 XP, which is, you know, known for having a few hardware issues, and you're operating it in Texas and, you know, maybe not treating it well in terms of thermal, you know, shocks and others, like, then you could expect a few years. But I like your kind of framework on, you know, there's certainly going to be some companies that want to think about like the lifetime of the machine and different stages. And yeah, the international side's interesting, but again, you could run that playbook domestically too. You could have an on-grid opportunity that's 95% uptime, 5 cents, and then you move it to something that's 50% uptime and closer to 2 cents. So really it's just probably tinkering with the uptime and the cost when you're thinking about it from like a domestic standpoint. But yeah, I think that's going to be an interesting strategy for some people and some do today. Others, I think, will just try to specialize. And they'll be like, hey, we're really good at doing X, which is on-grid mining, 5 cents. We want to run the latest gen machines. We can raise capital for that 3 years, and then we'll sell them to somebody else. And so that life cycle will happen just within a few different companies.
This episode is sponsored by Hashbranch. the easiest way to mine Bitcoin in the US. Sourcing hardware and rack space usually is a mess. Bad deal structures, misaligned incentives, and no visibility after deployment. I have placed tens of thousands of ASICs in partnership with Hashbranch. What I like most is that they cut through the noise. Fair pricing, aligned terms, and access to hosting that actually works. Use code HASHRATEUP100, visit hashbranch.com today to get $100 off of each miner that you order.
I mean, did you see what Argo did with the 23,000 S19s that they had in Texas?
Yeah.
And that's also play, right? Low capex and then just go profit split somebody else that's willing to take them. I found that also very interesting. Where do these companies get their money from, Ethan, when they raise money for the latest gen machines? Who are the investors who give them that capital and say, yeah, mining is a great idea?
Yeah, I mean, so there's going to be like, there are different groups of investors depending on what vehicle you're using. So if you're raising like a big debt round, probably going to be less amount of investors coming into that round. And obviously they're more like a credit like fund. So these are companies that have some, you know, their mandate is to go and return some type of yield or some percentage return. And they want to basically be very high up in the stack. So they want to be senior secured so that if the company goes bankrupt, they're like first in charge of the assets, or they ring fence some collateral like Bitcoin in order to protect themselves. But they're happy with, say, a 5% return. And there's a number of these credit funds that have actively engaged with some of the Bitcoin miners. And then on the equity side, I think that's it is quite a bit more diverse. You have everything from like big equity funds, like the some of the big like Fidelities of the world participating, all the way down to like smaller hedge funds participating in some of these ATMs. And largely what happens here is public companies will go to an investment bank like an H.C. Wainwright or B. Riley or Cantor, and they'll run a process for them. So they'll create the offering, determine what's, you know, the deal structure, go meet with a ton of different investors, ideally sign some up and get the deal moving forward.
Yeah,
but okay. Most of that capital, to my understanding, is coming out of North America, augmented by some Europe and Asia money. But you know, predominantly the funds that they're meeting with are US based.
Yeah, and then it's no surprise that hash rate growth in America is so huge, right? Because for that capital, that's the market that they see objectively the lowest risk in. I do as well, but you know, if you're from the UAE, you have a different view on it. How do you see that developing, just briefly? I know, you know, after Bitcoin mainnet, there was a bunch of interest, especially with the US administration and the Strategic Reserve and all of that, all of those shenanigans that we've witnessed over the last 3 months. Is there a lot of activity? I know you guys are also active in that region. What are your thoughts sort of on mining in the UAE, especially as, I don't know, prices adjusted for risk, I don't think are much better or not better at all than in the US?
Yeah, I'm in no ways an expert here, but we have done some work with some UAE-based miners, and I was out there a few months ago. And my view is that like the Middle East, and UAE is a good example, is going to be dominated by a small group of players, probably in some ways government connected. So in UAE, for example, like the two big miners are 02, which is, you know, the spinoff of ADQ, the Sovereign Wealth Fund, and then Phoenix. You know, that largely represents the total mining that's happening in UAE. There was an opportunity to mine at like the few megawatt scale with some like of the cheap energy going to agricultural land. But my understanding is they're trying to crack down on that. And that wasn't the intention of, you know, what the power should be used for. So I think UAE will be very concentrated amongst a few players. It sounds like Oman is the same way. And then to be determined with Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, and some other players. So right now we think it's going to be a heavily dominated market by like government related entities or sovereign wealth funds. And they still have not figured out really how to do the cooling there effectively. And people have always pointed this out, like what do you do in 45 degree heat Celsius, you know, summertime. And if you run your machines in immersion, maybe that helps protect the machines. But what about all the electrical infrastructure out there? Like it's a significant problem in an industry that's trying to like minimize the amount of work and capex that goes into buildouts.
not just that, it's also desert, right? So from what I've heard, the go-to is hydro, because the dust particles in the electrolyte will actually make it not neutral anymore, and the machines will blow up, which is doesn't sound like fun. I don't know how much insight you have into this logistics, Ethan. I know you guys did a big deal with MicroBT. The headline was 131.4 million ASIC purchase and options agreement with MicroBT from you guys. For logistics from Asia to America to the rest of the world, is that an important piece, the Middle East, maybe, to tie that in?
Like in terms of logistics and the shipping systems?
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it's like an important, at least not in our business, and maybe we're missing something. But predominantly, like, our logistics business is largely like Asia to North America is the big shipping lanes, and then North America to North America domestic trucking. That's like vast majority of the shipping we do in logistics. We have imported to, I think, like 34 different countries globally now, but vast majority of that flow is happening Asia to US, US to US.
Okay, understood. That partnership, Ethan, explain that to me. Did you guys have some form of new venture or whatever? Explain to the listeners what that partnership between you and MicroBT is there. And you bought all of those machines for, basically.
Yeah. I guess we would like to look at ourselves as, you know, partner to MicroBT, but probably the better labeling is that we're, you know, a customer client in this particular example. So we purchased a number of machines. We purchased or, you know, put down deposit for a number of other machines and then also got some call options on future machines. And really the motivation there for us is that we're working with a number of partners to Luxor that utilize Luxor software and services, including our AC trading desk. They wanted access to MicroBT units, and we were in a unique position to get them access to them. We were very excited about that partnership, largely because of the onshore angle to it. So these machines are assembled in the US, and this is like in the early days of some of the border issues that were going on in the mining space. Of course, now they're widely reported on, but back in like late 24, they weren't as well known. And now we can kind of see the full extent of the potential risk that exists when you're importing machines into the US. The CBP and FCC seem to have, you know, full jurisdiction and discretion on, you know, how long to hold up machines for, how much storage fee to charge you, and you're basically at their mercy. So having an option that's kind of onshore is really nice to us, and people are loving the MicroBT unit. So we plan to exercise the entirety of that contract, and we're already well on our way to kind of finalizing that. And then hopefully in the near term, you'll see another announcement, and we'll re-up another contract with them of that, you know, similar size.
I mean, this was a good play. Those problems have gotten worse. I don't know what the current situation is on that import issue. From some I hear it's gotten better. The tariffs are higher. The machines are now manufactured in the US. Does that get you around the tariffs that the administration is currently imposing on stuff? Because the stuff is still coming from China, right? Or from Asia.
Some of the components, yeah. So my understanding is that the tariffs have been put in place on China, which is effectively doubling what they previously were, 25 to 50, and then there's some additional charges on. So it's like north of 50%. For electronic goods coming from China to the US. So that basically means that no ASICs will be imported from China to the US. It doesn't make economic sense. You would rather send them to another country. You'll just never return that investment. In terms of like the actual assembly, like there's probably, and I don't know the full supply chain, but I'm assuming there's going to be some tariffs on varying levels of the components that come in. But it's certainly done in a way that's, you know, much more efficient than, say, producing the machine in China and then shipping it in. Now, a lot of the, I'm going on a kind of tangent here, but a lot of the border issues, they weren't necessarily just to do with like manufacturing in China. We've sent machines in, as did a lot of other companies operating in the space, sent machines in that were produced in Southeast Asia into the US, paid all applicable tariffs, but the CBP held those machines up under inspection. And sometimes all we got back was that they're investigating it for being a radio frequency equipment and other kind of reasons that we felt were not justified. The industry really rallied around a couple lobbyist groups, and Senator Loomis and Ted Cruz and others kind of really went to bat for the mining industry to say, look, this is unfair treatment of American miners. These policies are only hurting America's competitiveness in this mining space. And that's largely been efficient right now. So like we just had a bunch of machines released. We're continuing to see those pains go away for now. It seems like there's a reversal there in policy, but it was definitely a few months of pain for us and other industry participants, and it cost us a lot of money, which was quite unfortunate.
Yeah. I mean, look, the ASICs from MicroBT are scarce as they come, as they are. I mean, you know, from what I understand, nowhere near the production capacity of their larger counterpart in the industry. And I think that we see a lot of this. I don't know where BitDeer is producing, but Auradine is obviously doing this. They're mining or their ASIC manufacturing in the US as well. This helps. I didn't know that they were assembled in the States. But yeah, I mean, that obviously is very important. And as you said, these tariffs, and I'm like struggling, you know, when I send a couple of machines here or there from Asia now, you know, I'm always buying machines that are landed in the US and a lot more expensive than they used to be. And it's not fun. And in most cases, I have to tell the people who buy low quantities, like, look, you know, I wouldn't want to send you anywhere else. These hosters are great, but these machine prices are just crazy. They make no sense. Okay. One crazy prediction that you made, Ethan. It wasn't a crazy prediction. Sorry. You said you were trading $500,000 per day last year when we last spoke, ASIC trading desk. Where are you guys with that today, volume-wise?
Yeah, we had a pretty good 2024, and I think, you know, part of that is just industry tailwinds that benefited everyone in the space, like the growth of the public companies that I mentioned. And obviously, when the network adds 300 exahash, there's a lot of room there to participate. So I do want to be kind of conscious that we're operating in a good market condition. But we did about 410 million of ASIC trading in 2024 across our desk, so just over a million a day to round out the year. And I think it's been higher than that so far in Q1, although I don't have the final numbers yet. But yeah, it's certainly been pretty high volume, and we see that as like a key value add for like an ASIC trading desk, both Luxor and in general. Is like when you interface ASIC trading desk, you basically want to go to them and get close, like really good pricing. So can they execute like mid-market? Can they execute in size? Can they execute quickly? And so the more volume you have on both buy and sell side, ideally that creates like a better user experience for whoever you're trading with, both on buy and sell. So that's our goal, is to like really increase liquidity and be able to be, you know, a trustworthy and quick moving counterpart for anyone on both sides of the trade.
It's a volume game, right? At the end of the day, because it's a race to the bottom, and moves like that strategic purchase agreement that you have with MicroBT obviously help lock in units, lock in supply. Especially, do you see the market realizing the difference in quality between MicroBT machines and Bitmain machines and their demand going up? Do you see that at all, or is it still purely looking at paper efficiency, hoping for the best?
I think that there is some like element there that people are like weighting certain considerations more than others. So for example, like an Avalon machine, you know, Canon's had like a pretty good year. I think they are trying pretty hard to represent themselves well at conferences. They have a few key clients like Cypher and otherwise that have, you know, placed good orders with them, and their reputation is building. But overall, they are kind of playing catch up against, you know, the Antminer and WhatsMiner brands. And so for them, they basically have to offer, you know, a similar style efficiency, or, you know, at a lower price, because people are weighing in, okay, what about if this machine fails and I have to file a claim? Like, what's their customer support like? What's the failure rate like? How does this operate in my condition? And so I think miners are kind of, you know, they do think about those other considerations, not just purely from an Excel standpoint, efficiency and looking at dollars per terahash. In regards to MicroBT and Bitmain, pretty much consistently you'll see MicroBT price at slightly higher than Bitmain. So if you're a big pubco and you're going to Bitmain for an S21 plus deal, you know, they're giving you a significantly lower price on an efficiency adjusted basis than what MicroBT is for the M60X series. And MicroBT is still selling a lot of units, and I think that speaks to some of the great reputation they have across, you know, a number of large scale miners that are really happy with their product and have enjoyed it. But yeah, so I think there's, you know, quite a few considerations there. And I certainly think as new entrants come to the market, like Auradine and Bitdeer, you know, they need to find what their differentiator is. You know, from Auradine's perspective, maybe it's that US onshore, maybe it's them optimizing for different form factors and integration with demand response. But at the end of the day, they're probably still going to have to price lower than Bitmain, because on an efficiency adjusted basis, because people trust Bitmain more and they're more de-risked at this point. So I think there's always going to be these kind of gaps, some of which are subjective, between the pricing of the equipment.
Yeah. I mean, you guys just came out with the LuxOS results, which were crazy, 12.5 joules per terahash for the S21 XP. I know these aftermarket firmware updates are not really available for MicroBT. Maybe you can explain why. And there's also been a third-party firmware lock by Bitmain, I understand. So how has that sort of impacted LuxOS's business line? How are you getting to these results and your experience with the newer gen Bitmain machines? Are they addressing quality concerns of the S19 line at all, or not really?
Yeah, a lot to unpack there. And I think we, you know, briefly talked about it a year ago, but really, like, when we were looking at the firmware space back in 2021, there was no US-based firmware options. And so that was the initial intention, like, hey, can we just offer a product that's, you know, almost at, you know, feature parity as some of the other products that are out there, but domicile in the US, build it in the US. And that's kind of the differentiator. That was the initial vision. Obviously now we're much more ambitious. We think we've surpassed and want to continue to surpass in terms of, you know, features and performance, but it's been quite a success so far. I think we're on 27 exahash worth of machines to date. So LuxOS is, you know, running about 27 exahash of equipment. I think, you know, part of that is just really the performance of the auto tuner and then different profile sets. So the stock firmware that comes from Bitmain and like the Antminer model, relatively not optimized for frequency and voltage going to the boards. And so there's ways that you can optimize and just quickly improve the efficiency of the equipment through small tweaks of that. But then really, I think the future of mining, in our view, is like intelligent mining. And without sounding too derogatory, but up until now, most miners have been doing what I would consider like dumb mining, or rudimentary, let's say, to be polite, where it's like, okay, if, you know, power price is under 6 cents a kilowatt hour, run the machines at full tilt. If it goes up, then turn the machines all off, or flip a switch or a breaker and turn them off. In the future, I think the miners that really differentiate are going to be looking at alternative factors, such as like, okay, what are hash price dynamics right now? Is the mempool filling up right now with whatever Taproot Wizards print? Should I be overclocking my machines because of, you know, that mempool activity? How do the hash rate forward markets look over the next 7 days? Maybe I'm trading day ahead hash price markets. Maybe power prices, you know, we're looking at it on a more granular level. And really taking that logic, feeding it into the decision-making at the farm level. And that's where I think firmware really unlocks, because it kind of sits as that command item on the machine. So it can take in these external price signals and direct the machine on what the best way it is to run. And so we think there's a lot of room to go there in terms of all models across Antminer, and then hopefully as well other manufacturers as well.
Would the machines then have to talk to each other as well? Or can you do each machine for itself? You guys thinking about miner management software, something external in a farm on a Raspberry Pi maybe or whatever, on a local server that's running there from Luxa?
Yeah, as of now, we're not thinking of that ourselves, but I think you're highlighting a great point, which is there needs to be farm level logic built in. For example, maybe there's some electricity program of miners on where they don't want to dip below 2 megawatts. And if they do, they get penalized for that. And so you need to build that into the logic where it might be, from a pure machine basis, profitable to turn every machine off. but maybe there's some alternative, you know, reason in which you'd want, you know, to keep 2 megawatts of that farm running. And then you want to basically optimize too. Let's say the farm needs to curtail 3 megawatts out of 10. You don't want to just like shut off 3 megawatts worth of machines. What you want to do is you want to underclock and find the optimal setting for each of those machines. So say you have like half of them is S21 Pros, a few XPs, a few J Pros, you're basically setting what the optimal rate is on a per machine basis. So certainly I think there needs to be some cross communication across the farm.
All right, man. Yeah, and this obviously works a lot better when there's all these signals available. There's definitely parts in the world, which leads us back to the continent that I'm located on. You know, all of this is great, like public market availability, price data, real-time data for miners in the US, that's great. But we forget in most places in the world, this doesn't exist. So what you just said about, but on the contrary, something that does exist for everybody is network level data, right? So if you can optimize around that, that for a large part of the industry is game changing, right? Because in Ethiopia, your price for electricity is set by the government. And that's the case in many, many countries around the world. Hash rate growth in Africa, Ethan, over the last year, what have you seen? I know you've been traveling quite a bit, and I know you've been at least to Ethiopia, if not other countries. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, we missed you there last fall in Ethiopia. So next trip, we'll have to run it back together. But yeah, was fortunate enough to visit Addis Ababa and Hawassa back in October last year. Part of that was for the Gamma Conference, which I highly recommend people checking out. It's an awesome conference of a bunch of great Bitcoin miners in Africa. So it was awesome kind of regrouping with some of those people to see what the progress is like across, you know, their mining jurisdictions, many of which were outside of Ethiopia. But then really also just deep dive into the Ethiopian market, which we talked about in the last podcast. I feel like I've been talking about it for 2 years. So finally seeing it in person and visiting those farms was amazing. At the time, there was, I think, 600 megawatts worth of operational miners in Ethiopia. EEP said that would be, you know, closer to like 800 to a gigawatt worth by the end of the year. So I think now we're probably sitting north of a gigawatt worth of Bitcoin miners operating in Ethiopia. Based on my understanding of the space, I think there'll probably be another like few hundred megawatts added this year. Although it is kind of a hard to predict statistic because a lot of the miners operating there are private companies largely based in China. And so it's hard to understand, you know, what kind of power contracts and negotiations they have with the EEP behind the scenes. But then you could rely on some of the pubcos that operate there like Canaan and BitFuFu that are reporting some numbers. So yeah, we think there's going to be, you know, closer to like 1.3 to 1.5 gigawatts of mining done in Ethiopia by end of this year. And definitely excited about some of the other places in Africa, although I think it's, you know, certainly less so. We've heard a lot about like different projects being looked at and considered in Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda. Obviously, Marathon was like one of the big companies that announced early intentions of Kenya. It's unclear where that currently stands. I would put money that there's going to be some, you know, maybe 50 to 100 megawatt deployment in one of those three countries by end of year. And then we have been following the space in Nigeria, which seems to be quite positive. Obviously, you and I both have, you know, a couple friends that operate there on smaller scale, but there are a lot of companies looking at potentially leveraging the flared gas situation. And Nigeria is one of the biggest oil and gas reserves in the world. And so the flared gas situation that we talk about as an industry a lot is also applicable there. And I think there'll probably be close to like 100 to 150 megawatts worth of mining going on in Nigeria by end of year.
I know you've got a lot of experience in Paraguay. Where do you see parallels between Ethiopia and Paraguay? Do you see the same risk happening or existing for Ethiopia as well, where politicians just say, ah, look, this is great. Now we've got all the mining here. We can only import new gear. So all the capex is here already. Right. So for the listeners, you cannot import used machines into Ethiopia as it stands. And how about we just increase prices now? You know, what are these guys going to do? They know which machines are there. if they're smart enough, they figure out what sort of efficiency you have, what revenue per kilowatt hour the average fleet will have in Ethiopia. Is that a risk?
I think it's a risk in any market. And you could probably point to like Kazakhstan, even prior to Paraguay, as another area in which, there is some element of like fast growth, very maybe too quick, and then some element of just not interacting with government and local bodies in the correct manner and then getting caught on the wrong side of that trade. So Paraguay, seems to be that way. Of course, there are miners like Hive, for example, that are negotiating directly with the government and finding still, deals that are win-wins, ideally win-wins for them. So there's still room in Paraguay, but I think largely that industry has faced very high, blowbacks from the electricity provider. Miners have been basically put on with an electricity rate that's higher than any other industrial user, which is obviously not the fair treatment of miners that we all want to see around the world. In Ethiopia, that potentially could happen too. I think there's definitely different dynamics in relation to China's involvement, all these state-owned enterprises that have built out the substations and the electrical infrastructure and their influence. So there's a different power dynamic there and geopolitical dynamic, but I think miners need to be very wary that the government at any point in time could try to rug pull them, and they need to be forward-looking and interacting with the government and making sure that they see it as a win and that the people see it as a win.
Yeah, look, I advise people when I speak to them, look at, again, risk-adjusted cost, right? And if you look at the U.S. and Texas where the Senate is mining, at least from my understanding, and you pay 4 cents from the grid, that's your 10-year treasury right there, your 10-year U.S. treasury, right, for mining. And if you then pay 3.5 cents in Ethiopia, is that worth it? I don't know, right? You can only import new machines, as I said. Now, we've seen prices go up already, and I'm very wary of the sort of regulatory volatility, let's call it, around that nation at the moment. And I'm going to have Nemo from QRB Labs on again here soon to maybe get a bit of on-the-ground knowledge where we are at the moment. I know they are also growing, which is great to see. I'm very hopeful on Nigeria. I think that's where you can reach a certain size and things are more private. And it's going to be the same in more African nations as well. Here in South Africa, if you basically have zero regulation when it comes to energy production if you're below 10 megawatts. But as soon as you reach a certain scale, now mining is not permissionless anymore, right? Now you work with governments and large investors and interests, and you're negotiating, and that's where the fun starts or stops, depending on where you are. Ethan, we're out of time already. I feel like we just started talking only now. I think we'll have to do this again before a year has passed. Is there anything before we close out and you tell people who don't yet know where to find you, anything I didn't cover that you wish I had? Otherwise, feel free to close out and leave us with last thoughts.
Yeah, always too many topics to cover. We got a really good coverage of like the hash rate derivative market last conversation. So if listeners are interested in that, I'd recommend revisiting that conversation. But that market's progressed a lot. We have about half of the large companies and a lot of private miners that are using our hash rate derivatives markets to hedge and sell forward. So it's been great progress there. Miners are coming to us with 2-3x a hash and looking at, 6 months contracts. So the liquidity is there and volume's picking up, which we're really excited about. Before we end, maybe let's throw out some wild estimations so that we can laugh at ourselves in a year's time.
Okay, go. I mean, you're going to be here way before a year. I'm going to make that happen because what you just said is really interesting. Cool. What do you want to do? Hash price next time we meet. Call it 6 months from now.
Let's say end of year 25.
Okay, go.
So just over 6 months.
Okay.
$35 petahash per day.
Okay.
Network hash rate 1.05.
Talking Zeta. 1.05.
Zettahash.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, what else? ASIC desk trading volume.
In 3 years, this is a projection, we won't quote machine efficiency in joules per terahash. We'll quote it in joules per petahash.
No.
It's going to happen.
Do you think there's much more room? I don't know. I know nothing about this, but my basic understanding is we're limited physically to the nanometers that we can reduce by.
You just don't want to compare and be like, oh, you know, this machine's 5.57 joules per terahash versus this one's 5.68. Just increase the denominator.
But I think then the efficiency comes. There's much lower hanging fruit, right? Anyway, next time. Tell people where to find you, Ethan.
Quoting from Bitcoin to sats, quoting hash price to petahash, quoting efficiency to joules per petahash. It's heading that way. But you can find us at luxor.tech and my Twitter, Ethan_Vera. So awesome to be on this again. It's always a pleasure to chat. So thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, Ethan. You'll be on sooner than you know. Cheers, man. Thank you. Bye.